Hi, I'm Joan Hubbard Cousins. Before finding my way back to our remote Alaskan camp, I discovered how radically my perceptions, expectations, and choices changed during my 6 days of isolation when I never saw a trail, an old campfire, or even a footprint.
We travel for business. We travel for pleasure. We travel to expand our minds. Whether it's one state over or halfway around the globe. If the world's a book, why only read one page? I'm Elizabeth Hill, and you're listening to a WAMC Northeast Public Radio production. This is Postcards from the Road.
Blood strikes my eardrums like anvils again and again, faster and faster. Should I run, go limp, play dead, stand with my arms high so I look taller? Speak with authority? People swear each one of these will be the only thing that will save my life.
This episode is the conclusion to Joan Hubbard Cousins' Alaskan journey. The stories you're about to hear have been adapted from her nearly completed memoir, Hiding and Seeking, A Search for Belonging in Wild Alaska. She currently lives on the road with her wife, traveling with Rosie, their tiny home on wheels. This is Episode 7, Part 2, Found.
The buzz of a bush plane angling towards the Yukon shreds my shroud of silence. Abruptly, I cease tromping along the creek to scan the sky. It's the color of dingy underwear. Still, for days, every time I look up, hoping to snatch some sense of direction from the sun, all I see is a low, mottled cover, keeping me from finding my way home. In the 5 days since storming out of camp, I've heard a few planes, but they were gnat-sized near the horizon. This one's heading straight for me. A search plane with DB on board? Abandoning all fear of slumbering bears, I plunge into a thicket of alders. What's wrong with me? If I had any sense, I'd be out there waving like crazy. Instead, I turn my back, hoping my navy backpack will meld better with the leaves than my orange plaid work shirt. Go away, leave me alone. I can do it myself. The words drone over and over, a mesmerizing chant, until the plane sounds like the voracious mosquitoes that harassed us for months as we started building our cabin. Am I nuts? Without food, how much longer can I last? The blueberries are so acidic, I can only eat one or two handfuls a day. Rose bushes jostle for position along the creek, ripping my blue jean cuffs ragged, and after biting into a withered rose hip and discovering wiggling white worms, they dropped from my menu. Lots of plants are still green in late August, but which ones will kill me? I'd trade my university degrees for a smidgen of knowledge about wild edibles. The plane grows louder, white with red markings, four-seater, one propeller. Retreating deeper into the thicket, my gut churns and my face burns. Please don't be looking for me. I don't need any help, really. I'll find my way home. I just need a small break in the clouds, just enough to see the sun or the moon moving. Hiding is such a habit, it's instinctive. At 3, I stashed snacks in my stuffed bunny's pouch, then waltzed virtuously past my mother to not take the nap she insisted on. Now at 28, shame makes me hide. Shame that I'm lost and need help, that I left DB, my girlfriend, in a huff, that I was stupid enough to strike out into the wilderness with no food, no map, no compass. Leaving camp, no matter how impulsive, was never meant as some oblique attempt at suicide. I just wanted space to think, to feel, to flee everyone's desires, especially my own. As the Cessna engine fades, my dismay intensifies. I should have waved wildly, gotten the pilot's attention. For 15 hours every day, I'd been searching for a way back to our camp on the Chattanooga River until the gloaming makes me stop, build a fire, dry my rain-soaked clothes, and sleep under a spruce. I've never seen one side of a human being, not even a footprint, for 5 days. This is wilderness, not the road-checkered woods of my Girl Scout days in Virginia. After emerging from the alders, I sit by the creek, sipping water while gazing at my only companion, the photo of the Holy Mother, eyes closed in meditation. I'm just getting to know her, reading a few pages whenever I need to rest or soothe myself. Is this serene-looking woman for real, or is she hiding behind some holy facade, just pretending to be at peace? My own mother pretended to be a lot of things, but peaceful wasn't one of them. Mom hid a lot from me. She'd sit in bed, sometimes all day, surrounded by textbooks as thick as dictionaries, underlining and making notes. At times, I'd stand outside her closed door, afraid to knock, listening to pages turn. "Come out, come out," I'd silently plea. She had to know I was there and open the door. At 8, I didn't understand that my longing for attention was trumped by Mom's craving for admiration and respect. If I got brave or desperate and knocked on her door, I'd wait for Mom to drag her eyes from the pages, her face so devoid of expression that I slid my hands up and down the sides of my thighs, just to be sure I wasn't invisible. Studying me, my mother's face looked like she was in a wax museum, incapable of meeting anyone's eyes with interest. Responses to my requests often ricochet into the future. "Just bear with me until," and she fills in a date that's days or weeks away. Exams, papers, internships, comprehensives, dissertations rise up over the horizon in a dismaying succession, like cowboys on galloping steeds, bandits riding hard, stealing my mother away. Mostly I just listen outside her door as pages turn, then retreat to the basement to play sonatinas on the piano or create magic tricks with my chemistry set. I bury myself in Nancy Drew mysteries and cinnamon toast. I flee outside, pedaling furiously on my gearless blue bike, pretending the sound of the playing cards, clipped to the spokes, make it a motorcycle taking me far away. I do anything to keep from knocking on that door. A woodpecker's rapping startles squirrels who break into a scolding chorus. Smiling at the familiar sounds, I feel less grimly alone. After slipping the Holy Mother book into my pack, I resume trudging, searching for the Chattanooga. With no trail to follow, I tame my fear by rarely losing sight of the creek as it meanders through the valley, thick with spruce, birch, alder, aspen, and willow. I have no inkling that by midnight, my nascent discomfort will erupt into terror. After slogging along the creek for hours, always scanning for natural breaks in the brush to avoid startling a bear, I come upon a tiny clearing with a matted circle of grass that's still warm. Was a bear napping here? Where did it go? Slowly, quietly, methodically, I turn in a circle, probing for anything unusual. Suddenly, the gentle creek and its quiet surroundings feel ominous. My heart drums a racier rhythm each time I approach another clump of alder or willow. They feel like minefields, the potential source of a ferocious explosion. Like the brazen black bear that invaded our camp, clawed open my tent after sniffing an empty prune wrapper inside, raided our food cache when camp was vacant for one day, lurked nearby for a week, then lumbered into our clearing, ignored Hita's barking and our banging on pans. Sherry Kay shot it right beside our tent. Only her 30-30 stopped it. I've got to run, but where? Been wandering this damn creek for days. Everything looks the same. Ridge on one side, creek on the other, trackless vegetation everywhere. No sun, no moon, no stars, just clouds. Only thing I know for sure is that fear is my most dangerous predator. I've got to control it. Further up the creek, I slough off my pack, close my eyes, and start taking long, slow, deep breaths. I stumbled on this way of calming myself a few days ago. My taut alertness begins evaporating. Holding the Holy Mother book, I let it fall open, hoping to find solace and wisdom there. You will never be pushed beyond your endurance. When you're in need, call out to me with your heart, and I will be with you. Always remember, you are never alone. Now that's hard to believe, Flipping to the front of the book, I gaze at Holy Mother sitting with her eyes closed in deep repose. She's modestly draped in a flowing white sari, only a glimpse of dark hair and the tawny skin of her serene face show. Touching the photo, I long to absorb her peacefulness, like Braille, through my fingertips. That I found comfort and companionship in the Holy Mother puzzled me. She was the antithesis of my feminist ideal. I liked being strong, independent, equal to men, yet she'd done just the opposite and seemed far more at peace. A smile sprang to my face. Ha! I bet if a big old bear growled in your face, you'd be scared too. Slipping Holy Mother into my pack, I searched for a spruce that could shelter me for the night. A branch cracks, snapping me awake. Something large is moving down the ridge towards me in the night. Its lumbering body hidden inside stands of spruce and willow. Pushed aside branches recoil. Must be a bear or moose. Nothing else makes that much noise. Blood strikes my eardrums like anvils again and again, faster and faster. Should I run? Go limp? Play dead? Stand with my arms high so I look taller? Speak with authority? People swear each one of these will be the only thing that will save my life. Confusion grounds me. Does it smell the fire I just doused, or me? I don't have my period, no blood scent to signal I'm prey, no alluring food aromas, that's good. Hands creep from mummy bag, fingers dig deep to chilly loam, seeking something to hold on to. Wish I had a gun or a friend's hand, anything to touch. Curled in a ball, I listen and wait. The next morning, I know I must take a new approach. After 3 days roaming up and down this creek, I couldn't find the route I'd taken here from the Chattanooga. The ridge on my left sure looks like the one we're building our cabin on. Maybe the Chattanooga is on the other side. Once I start climbing that 1,500-foot ridge, my pace slows dramatically. On my sixth day with almost no food, it's harder than I thought. But when I get to the top, I'm sure I'll see Murphy Dome, and then I'll know how to get home. That's worth a climb. Sure wish I'd flagged down that plane instead of hiding. That was stupid. Being rescued by a search party is embarrassing, but dying out here is a lot worse. Hours later, after reaching the crest, I scoured the far ridge looking for the three white puffballs of the surveillance radar station. It was the only distinctive landmark in all these rolling hills. At 3,000 feet, the Air Force facility sat on the highest prominence in the region. Yet I saw nothing. Absolutely nothing. I peered into the valley. Is that the Chattanooga? A river definitely snaked between the ridges, but it's hidden by the trees. I won't know until I see its tawny brown 20 feet wide and flowing to my right. Tromping down the ridge, I know I have to let go of hope. Hope had me search for days, climb this ridge, then drop me hard when there was no Murphy Dome in sight. The Holy Mother said letting go of expectations is the key to happiness. But how do I do that? My mind couldn't let go of Murphy Dome. It ricocheted from one possibility to another, seeking some explanation for the dome's disappearance. Fear threatened to sweep me down in a landslide of panic. I descended more slowly now, feeling tired from the day's exertion and finding it harder to read the erratic ground cover in the dusky light. After stumbling over a thatchwork of tree debris, I knew I had to stop before breaking something. But it was hard to stop. I craved to see that river, to know it was the Chattanooga, if indeed it was. A few minutes later, I stepped into a small meadow and decided to make camp there in the middle of the slope. The river would have to wait. That night, I searched the heavens. I knew this sky. It was our living room ceiling back at camp. After a long day of work, we sat around the fire circle, cooking, eating, talking, sharpening tools, smoking or toking. We always tried to predict the next day's weather by reading the sky, so I knew exactly how the moon moved over our camp. Trouble was, the orb had been hiding ever since I got lost. Gazing at my hands, I thought, I admired their strength and sturdy yet graceful shape. Then I noticed the shadows they cast on the ground. The moon must be out. I flung my head back, and there it was, pouring light on me, etching jagged lines behind the spruce trees that edge the clearing's eastern side. Observing the moon moving that night, I became convinced that I was downriver from our camp, even though I'd walked upriver on my first 2 days. I never could reconstruct how I arrived at this conclusion. That night, the moon seemed to illuminate my inner knowing that it had eluded me until then. Tomorrow, I needed to complete the circle I'd almost made by walking upriver to our camp. It would take far more effort to walk along the river, following its serpentine course, would add extra miles, and on this part of the river, there probably wasn't a people trail. Plus, prickly rose bushes flourished near water, creating thorny barriers. It would be a lot easier to walk on the top of the ridge following the bear trails, yet climbing up takes a lot more energy than walking down. Plus, I'm more likely to run into bears on the ridge. Deciding I'd rather take my chances on top, I fell asleep, feeling excited that tomorrow I might finally find my way home. The next morning, I felt like a marionette whose puppeteer had dumped her. I had absolutely no energy. Is this it? Am I going to lie here, waiting to die? Once again, the slow rhythm of my own deep breathing soothed me. In time, the sun peeked around the ridge, warming my face and heating my body. Several hours later, I finally sat up, put on my hiking boots, and drank some water. To stand, I turned onto my hands and knees, then worked my way up, slowly, to an upright position. I felt woozy. Every other morning, I'd felt vigorous. Clearly, yesterday's climb took a tremendous toll, and now I was about to do it again. I stepped forward boldly, but within a minute, I collapsed onto the hillside. I tried to think, but my mind faded in and out, like a cell phone, almost out of range. My vision oscillated between clear and fuzzy, like a camera struggling to focus. I just wanted to rest. I'd been on the move all day for 6 days, sleeping in a different place each night, and I'd done this with almost no food. But if I gave in, I might never wake up. I had to focus my will. I couldn't think about the top. It was too far. I couldn't think about Murphy Dome. I had to live for this moment, not for what might happen later. I rolled onto all fours, pushed up into a standing position, and began putting one foot in front of the other at an achingly slow pace. Focused totally on my feet, I forced each one to march with a mantra I chanted in my head. One step at a time. One step at a time. The words and their rhythm worked. I climbed for almost a minute. Then I collapsed and slid easily toward sleep. Something jolted me awake. I refused to be some bear's lunch meat. Come on, let's go. Pushing up. One step at a time. I finally made it to the top by resting every minute or two, chanting every step of the way. Then I followed the bear trail as it meandered in an upriver direction. The ground was firm and blessedly flat. Since it was the easiest walking I'd done since leaving camp, my spirits lifted and pace quickened. Something moving in the grass caught my eye. Approaching cautiously, I realized it was the first human-made thing I'd seen in 7 days. It proved that at least one other human had passed through here. This icon of civilization, an old bread wrapper, would usually provoke me to grumble or rebuke at litter bugs. Now I wanted to throw back my head and holler, "I've been saved!" But that seemed a bit melodramatic. So I just folded the cellophane and slid it into my jeans pocket. Not long after the bread wrapper, something else grabbed my attention in the distance. Stopping, I stared. There it was. Finally. Three white mushroom shapes on the far ridge. Murphy Dome. I'm not lost anymore. Now I'll find my way home. But my exhilaration was tempered by exhaustion and knowing I still had miles to walk. All it takes is one misstep, and I'll die with a broken ankle while gazing at Murphy Dome. I've got to stay focused, keep my eye on the ground every step of the way. I'll celebrate when I get to camp. I continued just as before, taking one careful step at a time. When I got closer to Murphy Dome, I began angling down the ridge, aiming for our camp. Instead of feeling exhilarated, I noticed whiffs of regret about returning to what people so blithely call civilization. I dreaded getting swept up in a whirlwind of wants. I wanted the physical comforts and safety of camp, yet I feared the emotional discomforts I would face with DB. After an hour or two making my way downhill through the dense forest, I came to a standstill, startled by what lay before me. It was a wide, totally clear trail extending in both directions as far as I could see. What is this? It looks like someone came through here with a bulldozer. Who would have done such a thing? Whatever. It'll be a lot easier walking on this, so I might as well see where it goes. I had never seen one sign of another human being until today, my seventh day in the wild. Not a footprint, an old campfire, a piece of litter, or cut down tree. Every step I'd taken had been on uneven terrain covered with multiple layers of vegetation in various states of decay. Walking on this was almost like being on a sidewalk. Within minutes, I came upon another startling sight, the cabin of our nearest neighbors, only a mile downriver from our own camp. How could this be? As I looked back at the trail, I realized it was the narrow path all of us used to walk back and forth to town. It hadn't changed, but I had. After I'd shopped for supplies on the busy streets of Fairbanks, this path always looked tiny to me, barely more distinct than a bear's trail. Now, after roaming for a week in the wilderness, the same trail looked like some tractor had scraped the earth bare. For the first time, I realized how much my perceptions could be altered by novel experiences. I didn't think the trail was different. It actually looked totally different. The glow of our neighbor's windows looked inviting, but I wanted to be home, to see DB, tell her what happened, end her worry, and start anew. After passing through the clearing, I climbed down the bluff and saw the Chattanooga for the first time since entering the magical valley almost a week before. I greeted her like an old friend I feared I would never see again. Scooping up cool water in both my hands, I drank as if from an oasis before continuing on the trail. When Keita didn't bark as I approached camp, I knew DB wasn't there. The thought of spending one more night alone, especially in our camp that was usually full of life, felt too much to bear. She was probably in town, launching a search. The idea made me cringe. All those people looking for me, filled with judgments about my stupidity and lack of preparedness. I have enough of my own judgments. I don't need anybody else's. As tears threatened, I glimpsed a campfire through the trees. Well, someone was there. Not wanting to startle her, I called out, "Hello, it's Joan. I'm back." "Joan," someone called, clearly excited. I strolled into the clearing as casually as I could, not wanting anyone to think I was in desperate shape. A dark figure bobbed towards me. Only Adrienne moved that way, rocking up on the balls of her feet with each step, as if she could barely contain her exuberance for what lay ahead. "I'm so glad to see you," Adrienne said as she embraced me, pack and all. "How are you?" Sitting by the fire, I recounted my adventures. Then Adrienne described how she'd left camp that morning, heading for Fairbanks to tell DB I still wasn't back. Although Adrienne is quite familiar with the trails, she got turned around and ended up in camp again. So Adrienne said to herself, "I guess I'm not supposed to go anywhere today." And she didn't. Otherwise, I would have returned to a completely deserted camp. The next day, we closed up camp and paddled across the Chattanooga, hiked 7 miles up to Murphy Dome, where we piled into my Blazer and drove 20 miles to Fairbanks. There I learned that Calf, DB's first love, had split up with her honey. I instantly knew that meant DB had left me for Calf. It was not what I had expected. But getting lost wasn't what I'd expected either. The next year, DB and I worked as friends to complete her cabin. where she lived for nearly 20 years. I moved on to a place better suited to me, on the edge of the wilderness, not in it.
Postcards from the Road is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Our theme music is Kevin MacLeod's Cherry Blossom Wonders. And as always, if you like what you hear, subscribe on your audio app of choice. Visit WAMCpodcasts.org for more information.